turned themselves into vaults that hid the strongest evidence of the virus's lethality. Doors were shut so firmly that an award-winning documentarian even gave up on his effort to film in the U.S. and instead made his documentary about a country where he could get access to COVID patients, China. When it began in the U.S., the pandemic was a mass casualty event with few pictures of the casualties. Journalists who have covered wars and epidemics told Intercept that the obstacles they encountered during the first waves of the pandemic were unparalleled in their careers. Misha Friedman, who worked in public health before becoming an award-winning photojournalist, was shocked at the obstruction in New York City, saying, "I tried to go through doctors and nurses. I tried to go to the top. I even went to someone who was on the board of a hospital, a billionaire, and said, 'I understand, but I don't want to get involved,'" Friedman explained. Lucas Jackson, a photographer with Reuters, noted recently that he worked for one of the biggest news companies in the world and couldn't get access to a single hospital within 100 miles of NYC. One of the few photographers who had success early in the pandemic was Victor Blue, working for the New York Times. But Blue is deeply critical of what happened to other reporters. NYC hospitals should be ashamed for keeping out journalists. "I believe it worsened and prolonged the pandemic," Blue wrote on Twitter earlier this month, adding, "I was frustrated and angry more hospitals weren't opening up. There was plenty of room for every outlet to go and get access." The experience of being shut out was not universal. Blue worked alongside Sherry Fink, who has a medical degree from Scotland University and embedded in an Ebola treatment unit in Liberia in 2014. Fink reported from inside a number of hospitals early in the pandemic and noted in an interview that the early months were truly the great unknown, with tremendous fears that hospitals could spread the virus. "In previous emerging outbreaks, hospitals have become points of amplification," she noted, adding, "they have become places where the disease explodes and spreads." There are many reasons the U.S. COVID death toll has surpassed 750,000, beginning with dismissive rhetoric from the Trump administration that encouraged Americans to doubt the seriousness of the virus. But there is less examined reason, too. Hospitals hit the human devastation in the pandemic's early days, when opinions and policies were indelibly shaped. The COVID-19 pandemic began a mass censorship event. When there is a hurricane, flood, or wildfire, the damage is not hidden. In those emergencies, there are few restrictions on what journalists and the public can see. The snap trees submerge the streets, bodies floating in water, houses in flames. But the worst destruction of COVID-19 is not on display in places where journalists can bear witness as they wish. Most of the sick, dying, and dead are in medical facilities whose economic interests are best served by keeping journalists away. That's how you get a cataclysm without the visuals of cataclysm. U.S. hospitals are a mix of for-profit and non-for-profit entities. Though all must focus on the bottom line, some more fiercely than others, their executives often earn salaries on an exorbitant par with the rest of corporate America. At Mass General Brigham, a non-for-profit hospital for system in Massachusetts, 17 executives earned more than $1 million in 2018. The chief executive earned about $4 million that year. One of the system's main hospitals, Massachusetts General, told The Intercept in a statement last year that it did not allow photographers inside for the privacy of patients and also for their safety and that of the staff. When the U.S. death toll reached 500,000 early this year, the New Yorker published a story about the milestone, using a photo that showed a crematorium worker amid stacks of coffins. But these were not U.S. victims, they were Italians. The photo was shot in Italy in 2020. It has not been unusual for U.S. publications to use pictures from other countries to illustrate the human toll of the pandemic. When the New York Times published a year-end pictures portfolio for 2020, the main photo for March was from Bergamo, the epicenter of Italy's outbreak. The photo, which shows medical workers around a COVID patient at his home, was shot by Fabio Bosserilli and is one of the strongest images to emerge from the pandemic's early phase. The picture's intimacy stemmed from Bosserilli gaining close access to COVID patients, access that most U.S. photographers could only dream of.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report by The Times has revealed detail about one of the largest civilian casualty incidents in U.S. history. On 18th of March 2019, the U.S. military carried out an attack in the town of Baruz in eastern Syria. An F-15E attack jet targeted a crowd of people in Baruz with a 500-pound bomb. 5 minutes later, it dropped another even bigger bomb, and then another. Initial battle damage assessments put the death toll at around 70. The Times also revealed that following this strike, the U.S.-led coalition forces had bulldozered the blast site to cover up the incident. The U.S. military didn't publicly acknowledge the incident, and the death toll was downplayed. Finally, this week, U.S. Central Command acknowledged the attacks for the first time. It said 80 people were killed in the airstrike, including 16 Daesh terrorists and 4 civilians. However, saying it was not clear if the other 60 were civilians, it justified the killings by saying women and children might have been Daesh members. The report says the death toll was almost immediately apparent to the military officials. It said an Air Force lawyer present in the operation center at the time believed the attacks were possible war crimes, but regulations for investigating the potential crime were not followed.
Well, you know, in an ideal world, there would be a prosecution, there would be a trial and a proper hearing, but the way the world is run today, it's highly unlikely that the United States will, first of all, recognize any international court, and second of all, follow the judgment of such a court.
The admission was rather unusual, as more often civilian deaths are undercounted by the U.S. military, even in classified reports. Pentagon recently admitted that a drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul on August 29th was a botched strike. It killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. The attack came amid the hasty withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and days after a suicide bombing in Kabul International Airport that killed over 150 Afghans as well as 13 U.S. service members. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group named Air Wars showed that since 2001, at least 22,679 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as over 48,300.
Well, the fact is that if the world's so-called sole superpower can flex its muscles anywhere it chooses, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of international law, and regardless of public opinion worldwide, this gives the worst possible example to American allies, and that is follow the leader. If the United States can kill people at whim, at any place, at any time, then presumably its allies can do similar things.
Pakistan, in particular, has been the victim of U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. began its attacks in 2004 to kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. There are questions about how many civilians have been killed as a result of these strikes. According to the highest estimates, these strikes have killed thousands of people. The U.S. military, from CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. Nearly 1,000 strikes hit targets in Syria and Iraq in 2019 using 4,729 bombs and missiles. The official military tally of civilian death for that entire year is only 22, and the strikes from March 18 are nowhere on the list. The strategic province of Ma'arib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, Khaled Said Batarfi, confessed that the group's terrorists have fought against the Yemeni army and fighters from the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. He said Al-Qaeda terrorists have fought on 11 fronts. Yemen's interior ministry confirmed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed militants in Ma'arib, as Yemeni forces are pressing ahead with an offensive to liberate the city. However, Riyadh had denied such cooperation. The Saudi-led alliance had previously claimed it has crushed Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out attacks from Yemen. But in 2018, an investigation by the Associated Press found that the coalition has been paying some Al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and looted cash. According to the report, hundreds of Al-Qaeda members were recruited to join the coalition as soldiers.
The United States and Saudi Arabia created terrorism, beginning with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then moving these people that had been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Saudis, with the help of Pakistan, to the Balkans, to Yugoslavia, destroying that country. And then again, they were rebranded when they moved into Libya and Iraq and Syria as ISIS or IS or Daesh.
The report also revealed that the United States was aware of the arrangements and prevented drone attacks against the terrorists. Add to it Washington's logistical and weapons support for the Saudi-led coalition. This confirms that the U.S. is on the same side as the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda terrorists. A CNN investigation in 2019 found that Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners have transferred American-made weapons to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters and other terrorist groups waging war in Yemen. They use the weapons as a currency to buy the terrorists' loyalty. The US itself is also responsible for continually sending deadly weapons to the West Asia region. Washington is also responsible for providing them with heavy weapons. The program was a total failure and only contributed to the growth of the Daesh terrorist group and the humanitarian disaster stretching across Europe. Washington is also responsible for the creation of the Daesh terrorist group. It's also accused of transferring Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan before its shambolic withdrawal from the country.
I would certainly think so. I mean, the United States loses weapons. That's beyond belief. I think it's a way of saying, well, we either drop them to the Al-Qaeda people in the peninsula, or we gave them to the Saudis and the Emiratis to pass on to Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So it's basically hypocrisy, which the Americans are very good at. I think they learned it from the British. But certainly, these things don't go missing. They're provided, and they're handed over. The Americans are operating in Yemen themselves, although this doesn't seem to make the Washington Post. So it's, you're right that this is collusion and it's cooperation.
U.S. and its allies have flooded the region with weapons that have ended up in the hands of terrorists. This support for terrorists has fueled a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and children.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deems illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in this search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response.
In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruptions.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships, escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, in return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
President Joe Biden, who is facing low approval ratings, hopes the infrastructure bill will help him project sustained progress in confronting a surge in inflation and growing alarm about the midterm elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist and veteran White House correspondent Michael D. Scheer. The piece is titled, Biden Got His Bipartisan Win, Now Reality Sets In. For more than an hour on Monday, 15th of November, President Biden enjoyed the kind of political moment he had eagerly sought and long promised. Surrounded by a bipartisan cast of lawmakers on the South Lawn of the White House for the signing of landmark legislation forged through compromise at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. But after completing the signing ceremony for the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, Mr. Biden returns to a much harsher reality. Historically low approval ratings, unified Republican opposition to the centerpiece of his domestic policy, growing alarm in his own political party about the prospects of losing control of Congress in next year's midterm elections, and a surprising surge in inflation. The president and his aides are hoping that the highly choreographed event will begin to allow Mr. Biden to find his footing. They are betting that the bipartisan victory will allow him to project sustained progress in confronting the nation's problems, not just being different from former President Donald J. Trump. I truly believe that 50 years from now, historians are going to look back at this moment and say, that is the moment America began to win the competition for the 21st century. Joe Biden said, standing before hundreds of mayors, governors, lawmakers, and others, with the White House gleaming on a sunny Washington afternoon behind him. President Biden called the infrastructure bill proof that despite the cynics, Democrats and Republicans can come together and deliver results. But the president and his top advisors also understand the uncertainty in the country's deeply polarized electorate, the difficult battles yet to come on Capitol Hill, and the often fleeting nature of political victories in the age of 280-character messages on Twitter and vanishing stories on Instagram. Will Monday's victory be the stepping stone that Mr. Biden needs for a political turnaround proving to voters that they got what they expected when they put him in office last year? Or will it be a blip in time, destined to be quickly forgotten among the Washington rancor that is on the way in the days ahead? It is a victory in which Joe Biden's leadership really mattered, said Matt Bennett, a senior executive for Third Way, a Democratic-leaning group that presses lawmakers in both political parties to work together. That could signal that this is the beginning of a real virtuous circle for him. But Matt Bennett, who attended the signing ceremony, added that the real test for Joe Biden will be shaping the public narrative on the enormous benefits of the Infrastructure Act that is being signed today. That is going to require enormous discipline on the part not only of the president, he said, but also congressional Democrats. The outcome could help determine the fate of Joe Biden's presidency and the course of the Democratic Party as lawmakers prepare to defend their slim majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate in next year's midterm elections. Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio and one of 10 senators who worked to shape the infrastructure compromise, praised Joe Biden and Democrats in Congress. This is what can happen when Republicans and Democrats decide we're going to work together to get something done, said Rob Portman, who is not running for re-election. President Biden later called Mr. Portman a hell of a good guy, adding that he could only say that without hurting him politically because of the senator's decision not to seek re-election next year. Monday, 15th of November's signing ceremony was the culmination of a long effort for Joe Biden. In the Senate, the legislation passed by a lopsided vote of 69-30, with even Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader and a chief Biden critic, voting yes. In the House of Representatives, Joe Biden wooed a bigger-than-expected group of Republicans to support the effort to repair the nation's crumbling roads, bridges, and airports. That has been a bipartisan talking point for years. Even Donald Trump repeatedly proclaimed that it was Infrastructure Week in Washington, only to see little progress. This is a great accomplishment, Speaker Nancy Pelosi told the crowd on Monday, and there's more to come. That was clearly the message that President Biden wanted to send. His White House staff developed the event with the kind of stagecraft usually reserved for political conventions or campaign events. Flags from each state flapped in the background as Joe Biden, flanked by Vice President Kamala Harris and a union worker from North Carolina, strode to the lectern. Now the challenge for the president is to convince voters that passage of the legislation actually matters to their lives, that it is not just a Washington abstraction debated in the halls of Congress, but with little impact on their daily lives. That effort begins in earnest immediately. The ceremony on Monday, 15th of November, will be followed by a burst of presidential travel aimed at showing the American people real examples of how the new law will pump money into the economy and provide good-paying jobs by upgrading roads, bridges, lead pipes, broadband, and other infrastructure. On Tuesday, 16th of November, Joe Biden traveled to New Hampshire, where he spoke at a bridge over the Pemigewasset River, which is in critical need of repair and rehabilitation. The next day, he will visit a General Motors electric vehicle assembly plant in Detroit, Michigan, to showcase the billions of dollars to be spent on upgrading electric charging stations around the country. Now is an opportunity for the President, the Vice President, our Cabinet, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said on Monday, to be out in the country connecting the agenda, the impacts on people's lives, moving beyond the legislative process to talk about how this is going to help them. And we're hoping that's going to have an impact, but history suggests the president and his team have their work cut out for them. Former President Barack Obama campaigned around the country during his first term in office, telling the American people that the Affordable Care Act would bend the cost curve for the health insurance and improve coverage. But early glitches in the Obamacare website and opposition from the newly formed Tea Party made the law toxic in many places for many years. After Donald Trump passed tax cuts early in his tenure, he hosted a similar celebration, though without the bipartisan sheen, and then failed to sell it to the broader American public. Throughout his tenure, the tax cuts remained largely a partisan victory. During his campaign for president, Joe Biden promised that he would be able to win the support of Republicans and Democrats for his policies. That message resonated with voters after 4 years in which Donald J. Trump clashed spectacularly with the Democrats. But much of Joe Biden's legislation so far has been passed with little support from the opposing political party. His $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package was passed in the Senate and the House without any Republican support. And his $1.85 trillion social spending plan, known as Build Back Better, is likely to pass with only Democratic votes. At home, the president still faces deeply divisive issues, such as what to do about the border, clashes about racial sensitivity in schools, prison reform, and voting rights. And overseas, Joe Biden will be confronted with the need to rein in China and Russia, continue to repair relationships with allies. In his remarks on Monday, Joe Biden said, "As I look out on this crowd today, I see Democrats and Republicans, national leaders, local leaders, all elected officials, labor leaders, businesses," he said, clearly relishing the moment of victory in a tumultuous year. "Most of all," he said, "I see fellow Americans. I see America. Let's remember this day. Let's remember we can come together. Most of all, let's remember what we've got done for the American people when we do come together."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The enemy's efforts to promote the idea that Islam should not interfere in matters related to anything besides the individual.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Islam is an all-inclusive religion, and we should act in accordance with this all-inclusiveness. This is one issue. Another issue is the issue of Muslims' unity. These two issues are among the most important issues of our day. Of course, there are numerous important issues at the present time, and these two issues are among the most important ones. Regarding the issue of acting in accordance with the all-inclusiveness of Islam, there has been an insistent effort, mainly on the part of political and materialistic powers, to reduce Islam to matters related to the individual and belief only. This effort has existed for a long time. I cannot specify a certain date and say that such efforts started from that date, But from about 100 or 100 plus years ago, this effort has been pronounced in the Islamic world. This effort has doubled after the formation of the Islamic Republic.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They also try to make it look like it is not a political effort, and make it look like an intellectual effort. As the Westerners say, they have tried to theorize it. Thinkers, writers, activists, and the like are commissioned to write about this and prove that Islam has nothing to do with social matters, matters concerning life and fundamental issues regarding humanity, that Islam is a belief of the heart, and that it is a personal relationship with God and a series of individual actions based on this relationship only. They introduce this as Islam. They insist on proving this in the minds of their audience.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group which calls itself Moses' Staff has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus, but such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, 6 Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking. Just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britain's killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Puriza, Liverpool.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place, and it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's interior ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
The Palestinian Authority is experiencing the worst fiscal difficulties it has ever had since its establishment more than a quarter century ago. PA officials say this could soon reflect on its ability to pay its employees' salaries and conduct daily business. The European Union is the PA's largest single donor, but the bloc has not donated any aid to the authority so far in 2021. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtayi has meanwhile told his cabinet several days ago that the PA hasn't either received any financial aid from the Arab countries for 2 years.
There's no doubt that the PA is going through a real and suffocating financial crisis. Its manifestations are evident. There's a budget deficit, an accumulation of debt, and delays in paying its obligations, the salaries, paying for the education, infrastructure, health, and all sections. It's undeniable that there is a clear decline in aid.
Along with the long-standing fiscal leakages that are contributing to the financial crisis, Israel continues to deduct millions of U.S. dollars every month from clearance revenue transfers. This is in response to the payments by the Palestinian Authority to the prisoners held in Israeli jails, their families, and the families of those killed by Israeli forces.
Taxes collected by Israel on behalf of the PA, including customs duties, constitute a major source of revenue for the Palestinian economy. Israel often uses the fund transfers as a bargaining chip in its volatile relationship with the PA. They do not want for the PA to have any strength. They want to use the money it deducts to keep control in a way or another on the PA.
Meanwhile, the World Bank called on donors to help reduce the budget deficit, saying that the financial situation remains fragile due to high public spending and very low external financing to the PA.
At the end of the day, observers have expressed concern that the increasingly cash-strapped PA could face financial collapse. PA officials say the main reason behind the financial crisis is the lack of international and Arab donations to the Palestinians. Mona Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
Vienna's International Book Fair, cancelled like many other events in 2020, has come back to life this year. With only vaccinated or recovered people allowed into the exhibition hall, visitors can move freely without face masks. More than 300 publishers from over 30 countries used the opportunity to showcase their new releases. One of them was Iran.
We are also pleased to have another event for Iran's presentation of Iranian culture, Iranian science and technology in the format of the excellent and eloquent books that have been produced by Iranian scholars and gifted philosophers.
Books here are mainly bilingual, an opportunity for cultural exchange.
This year, I'm very happy because one of my poetry books, which was published in Iran, is on display here. Of course, Iran is the center of poetry, and Iranian culture is deeply intertwined with poetry. I really wanted to publish my poems in Persian since my previous work published here in Austria was only in German.
For many, visiting the Iran stand was a trip down memory lane.
Mashhad,